The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. And it's time for another installment of our Urbanite Radio Stories, where we bring articles from Urbanite Magazine to our airwaves. Today, we take a look at Michael Corbin's piece, The Ultimate Punishment, which asks why Maryland's death penalty remains in legal limbo. Capital punishment is legal in Maryland, but earlier this year, Governor Martin O'Malley, who is anti-death penalty, withdrew new procedures for carrying out lethal injections, which leaves the state without a means of actually administering the death penalty. Every year, the issue is debated in Annapolis, and it's never been brought to vote. But will 2012 be the year the issue actually gains traction in the legislature? Today, we're bringing you an interview with Kirk Bludgeworth, a man who sat on Maryland's death row until his innocence was proven and he was exonerated. He joined us in our studios in March of this year and is now an anti-death penalty advocate. Here's Kirk's story. We are joined by a man who's been in our studios, well, not these series, my other studios, and been on the show many times before, Kirk Bludgeworth. He spent 8 years in our prison system in the state of Maryland, two on death row for a crime he did not commit. He's the first person to be exonerated from death row for post-conviction DNA testing. And Kirk, good to see you, my friend.
Mark, it's a pleasure to see you again. It's been a while.
It has been.
Yeah. I'm back in Maryland and trying to repeal the death penalty.
Let's take a step backwards in time.
Mm-hmm.
For folks who don't know your name.
Right.
Because it's been a while.
Yeah, that's been quite – yeah, that's a good way to put it.
It's been a while. So talk a bit about your case in the history and what happened to you to get people a sense of who you are and where you come from.
Okay. In 1984, I was out of a discharged Marine, straight out of the Marine Corps. I was 22 years old. And at the same time, I was newly married, hadn't been, you know, married long, and was moved up here to Essex, Maryland.
Because you're from the Eastern Shore originally,
right? Right. I was born, I was a commercial waterman
down there.
So a crabber, you know, living on the Eastern Shore, country boy. Came up here and, like I said, got married. And this was in July of 1984. A little girl by the name of Dawn Hamilton was found brutally murdered in a wooded area near her home. A search had ensued for the person last seen with her. Was described as follows: 6'5", curly blonde hair, bushy mustache, tan skin, and skinny. Mark, you can look at me and tell that I'm not 6'5".
And you're not skinny either.
You got that right. But my hair was as red as a fire plug back that day. And you know, I had sideburns. There was a lot of things. And even the two main witnesses in the case, and there was five identification witnesses, and all positively identified me as the last person seen with Dawn. Now, the problem was the kids said that the hair was too red. Their hair was red, and this guy didn't have red hair. And there was a couple little things that kind of went along with the two main witnesses was an 8 and a 10-year-old boy at the time. Now, they're looking up at a man on the rise of a hill area next to where they were fishing at a pond. Dawn comes along. She's playing this game of hide-and-go-seek. She tries to help get them to help her find her friends that are hiding from her, and they don't want to help. They're fishing, busy. But this guy speaks up from behind them with the sun behind his head, and he looks down upon them and then walks off with Dawn, and she's, of course, never seen alive again. It was one of the most vicious murders in this state's history. It was a god-awful thing what happened to Dawn. She was, and I really, you know, don't like talking about the murder per se, but she was, sexually assaulted, bludgeoned, and it was just terrible what happened to her. And so, obviously, they wanted to find this guy. This all started from a next-door neighbor calling in to the police department. I was caller number 286. It looks like my neighbor, Kirk, in the composite sketch. Now, Mark, here's the thing. Now, back in those days, they had, and I think to some jurisdictions still use it, it's called an Identikit by Disney World, where they compile facial features of eyes, ears, noses, mouths, and to compile this composite. And it was done by one of the older of the two children, and this lady had seen it on TV and said, well, that looks like my neighbor Kirk, and called in. And this is how this whole thing started. Now, at the time, I was, like I say, I was newly married. Well, the marriage wasn't going very well. I was only up here for about a month, and I heard about the murder as well, read about it in the newspaper and seen it on television. They were in pursuit, you know, and all I could remember was thinking, I hope they get that guy. I never realized that they wanted to come after me.
So when they did get you and arrested you and took you into jail, I mean, people are kind of, it's still kind of mind boggling that you could be convicted with no direct evidence.
There was no physical evidence in the case. It was all based on the witness identification and circumstantial evidence. It was nothing. You know, they tried to say that I fled. You know, after this, I was having personal problems with my first wife. You know. And we weren't getting along. And so, you know, this is an old Rodney Dangerfield joke. You know, she was an earth sign, I was a water sign. Together we made mud. That's true. But, I had the toughest time trying to – I told everybody, Mark, that I was an innocent man. I unjustly accused and nobody listened to me. Here's how some of this stuff, I think, happened. I was arrested on a – Thursday morning, real early, big banging on the door, Baltimore County Police coming in and sort of, you know, you're under arrest, Mr. Bloodsworth, first degree murder, and said a few expletives to me mm-hmm. at the time. But I just didn't know. Now, they called every witness in the case and told them not to watch television. They said, look, we've arrested a suspect, don't watch TV, we're going to have a lineup on Monday. And, by the way, his name is Kirk Bloodsworth. They even told him who I was. There's a police report that states it, that they told him, some of these people told him who I was, which is another no-no. They go to the lineup on the Monday. Well, the two little boys never do identify me in the courtroom, I mean, in the lineup. It wasn't until 2 weeks later they called in and said it was really number six, and that's where I stood in the spot. Now, 2 weeks of trial, a lot of really shaky things in things taken out of context, and the gavel came down on my life on March the 22nd, 1985. I was on death row 8 months after my arrest. That is how fast it can happen to you.
I mean, just imagining anybody, you, man or woman, on death row, knowing you're sitting there, knowing you didn't commit the crime you can be convicted of,
right,
and that you could lose your life.
You could. It's we have now found over – I'm the first death row inmate, by the way, exonerated by DNA in the United States, actually in the world, and whoever had been convicted behind a capital –
I remember that very well, yeah.
Capital conviction. Now – I really don't like that the whole thing. I wish I was a baseball player playing for the O's or something. You know, but it's my cross, and I had to try to pick this thing up. But 140 people have been exonerated on death rows in the United States, and 17 of those have been DNA exonerations. We have over 265, I think. Is it 265? Angel, do you know? It's 265 people, I think, in the United States have been exonerated by DNA altogether. Compile that with the death row people.
You've stayed working with the Innocence Project around the country to
Yes. Well, I'm not necessarily affiliated with either one, but I'm affiliated with all of them. But more importantly, my life partner's organization, the Idaho Innocence Project in Boise, Idaho, run by Boise State.
Which is where you live now.
Where I live now.
Can't do much crabbing in Boise,
Idaho. No, but you can eat a potato, though. you can do that. But, it's really great. I started working with a really neat guy by the name of Dr. Greg Hampikian and others, and Angel O'Brien, my life partner, sitting in this room, who work on these cases to try to find out these people who committed, that are innocent, and try to get them out of prison. So I've been doing that for quite a while. And I work for a large nonprofit here in D.C., for criminal justice form. You know, Mark, I have a post-conviction DNA testing program in my name called the Kirk Bloodsworth Post-Conviction DNA Testing Program, and we just got some people out in Washington State by Bloodsworth funds, and another fellow in Arizona who spent many years in prison for a crime, for a rape he didn't commit, got out of prison as well. So, you know, I'm very active, and I just testified in Montana and came here to testify in front of the House Judiciary on the repeal bill, 1075. So, passed the bill, by the way.
So what do people say to you when you do this testifying who clearly are for the death penalty, senators and delegates from around the country, and they hear your story?
I think by and large, they're very moved by it, because here's the thing. I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, Independent, Green Party, whoever. You don't want an innocent person to die for something they didn't do or even be in prison for it. So, they're very sympathetic to my story and to to this thing. But we still holding on to some of these old beliefs. I would suggest that maybe if a senator had to be on death row, or a congressperson or somebody, anybody who, I was just a regular citizen. This doesn't happen to necessarily senators or congressmen. This happens to their voters. And we need to, maybe stop holding on to something that really has to go, because it doesn't work anymore.
I mean, Illinois overturned it.
Yeah, Illinois, New Mexico, New Jersey. I was worked in both of the all except for the exception of New Mexico. I worked in both of Illinois and New Jersey extensively to, push for repeal. And Maryland, since I can't remember, I've been out now since June of 1993. So.
Right.
I worked on a moratorium campaign here, and it's obvious that we can't fix it anymore.
I remember the first time you appeared on my show was at the end of 1993, shortly
That's
after
right.
you got out of prison. You came on the show, been on the show a number of times
yes,
since then.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And we have, people know that, we run a fair show and both sides can get heard in this air, but there are certain things I just make no bones about.
Right.
Death penalty being one that has got to go.
It does.
We
it
can't
really does.
Fry, hang,
hang, otherwise
gas,
kill
human beings.
It
doesn't matter.
We need to get rid of it and replace it with life without parole.
What do you think, folks? 410-319-8888 is the number here. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on the death penalty? Kirk Bloodsworth is with us. Spent 8 years in prison, including two on death row for a crime he did not commit, a heinous crime he was accused of. And first person to be exonerated from death row through post-conviction DNA testing. 410-319-8888. And it's not your fault, but there's no name next to these callers up here for some reason. They're just not popping up. So write it in a little note to the bottom, and I'll see their name, and we'll get them on the air. 410-319-8888 is the number here. What was your reception in Annapolis? Because I keep hearing politically they're not going to put it on the table this year.
Well, they should. They should take it to the floor and vote on it. I mean, I think we need to have an up or down vote. And let the senators and congressmen and representatives do this thing, and stop playing politics. I don't know who might be doing that, but I'm not the one to point fingers, but I was very well received, I thought. It was a bank of cameras, as I come into the hearing room. And, I know all the journalism people. I've met them over the years and got some good relationships with them, like you know, David Collins with Channel 11 and different ones, and just awesome, awesome people. Jane Miller, of course, she's my buddy. So, but I think it's about time. We need to get rid of this thing.
Let's hear what the folks are thinking.
410-319-8888.
And Russ, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark.
Hi, Russ.
And,
welcome.
Mr. Bloodsworth.
Thank you.
Kurt, I've heard you several times now, and I'm really impressed with you, man. You really did carry your cross. And I've heard
the check's in the mail, Russ. Really, thanks.
I heard you talk about Ambrose, the prosecutor, but I've never heard you so far talk about your counsel and your representation after your arrest. What kind of a lawyer did you have, and what kind of a job do you feel your lawyer did for you?
Well, okay, Russ. Let me tell you this really quick story. It's kind of funny, but not at the time to me. Now I want you listeners to picture the prison visiting room. There's a glass partition between you and your lawyer. My lawyer comes in off the street and he sits with his back to the brick wall, and you have to talk on the telephone between this glass partition. And so he's got his back to the brick wall, and the first thing out of his mouth, he says, "Kirk, you're in a lot of trouble." He says, "But don't worry. I know my way around a courtroom, and I know my way around the criminal justice system, and we're going to find our way out here together." So I started feeling a little better, Mark. You know, Russ, he's going to help me. So we talk about the case for about 20 minutes, and right before he gets ready to leave, he reiterates what he said in the beginning. He says, "Kirk, I know my way around the courtroom, and I know my way around the criminal justice system, and we're going to find our way out of here together." He put his hand on the glass to say goodbye. He picked up his briefcase, turned around, and ran right into the wall. That was my lawyer there.
What happened in court with your lawyer?
He was unprepared. Obviously, there was serology in my case. I'm not a serologist. I was a commercial crabber. I was 22 years old. I didn't have anything about blood typing. But just reading this thing, and it was obvious that there was several blood types on that. But the problem is that neither one of them was O positive, which I'm O positive. So the blood typing and the serology was wrong. And if I just had somebody to either took the test, the results of that to somebody like, say, John Hopkins, you know, big hospital, smart people, we would have found out it wasn't Kirk back then.
410-319-8888. Kurt Bloodsworth is in the studio with us. And Kevin in Annapolis, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Yes. Mr. Kirk. First,
yes.
Bear with me. I just come from the dinner.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. But anyway, Mr. Kirk, I'm so sorry to hear what happened to you. You apparently at 22 years old, man, you had to have been awfully a strong person. I mean, I can't fathom somebody telling me, "Look, I'm going to prison. Oh, I swear I'm going to death row for something I did." But nevertheless, I was curious, and I'm pretty sure other people were curious, that the state did it, so would you be compensated monetarily for the time you were away? And how does that work? I mean, being that the state did.
Well, I have to tell you that I was compensated by the state of Maryland after the first year I was out. I was in this state, you have to be pardoned by the governor in order to get compensated. Now, the other part is that in order to get compensated, that has to happen first, and then it's a statute in the law. So I got $300,000 for my 8 years, 11 months, and 19 days in prison, and 2 years on death row. Now, if you say it real fast, you know, over $250,000, it might sound like a lot of money, but it wasn't. Now, it takes a while, and I was one of the first ones, so I had my day, you know, and I would just suggest that we'd have a open federal compensation law for these individuals. I think it's states should grasp it, get a hold of this thing, because if a person that really does commit a crime has the same ability to go and get services from the government. There's so many different kinds of programs for them that they can plug into to get an apartment, to get a job, to, you know, to do some things. But what do exonerated people get? Nothing. they get let out. They gave me a little bit of money out of my commissary and told me, see you later. So I had to, you know, try to get compensation, and I was compensated, but it came to about a little over $10 a day.
$10 a day.
Yep.
So when you sat in this prison for 8 years, talk about the fight you made to get out. I mean, how did you begin to fight? Because, you know, that's everybody and their mother who's in jail, not everybody, but a lot of guys just fight to try to get out. They work in cases. But what did you do to get out? What was it like to battle this thing?
Well, I had to really push to get to find something, you know, find something tangible, because here it is. Mark, there was a 9-year-old little girl, Dawn Hamilton, needed somebody to help her get justice. Because I knew I was innocent, so that meant that whoever did kill her was still out there. I just, that was kept hitting. I couldn't sleep because I was thinking that whoever killed her was still at large. So I
did they find her killer?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I pushed so much for to get the DNA testing done that but it took 10 years. They were so interested in who committed this crime that the Baltimore County, it took them that long to put the testing in the CODIS database. Now, I was released in 1993.
Right.
It wasn't until 2003 that we found out who did it. And by the way, his name is Kimberly Shea Ruffner. He was arrested and charged with her murder and pled guilty to her murder in, I think it was May of 2004. And he's not 6'5". He's 5'6" and 160 pounds. So, you know, I worked really tirelessly. I read this book. I tell you what got me onto DNA was a book by Joseph Wambaugh called The Blooding. And it detailed the accounts of the first time genetic testing, fingerprinting was ever used in a town of England. So to make a long story short, they DNA tested the male population of this town called Narborough, and it came back a blank. But a couple days later, a person was overheard bragging in a pub to his friends that he had took a DNA test for someone else. And that person was Colin Pitchfork, the real Narborough killer. I had an epiphany, Mark, that is about the size of the state. If it can convict you, it can free you. And I just had to find the evidence. Now, that in itself is a story, too. I mean, the evidence in this case. So I write the prosecutors, let's get this, you know, written to, and they write me back and say, we regret to inform you that the evidence has been inadvertently destroyed. That when you get, we regret to inform you, you know you're lost. But I thought something was really odd with this. It's because we just had the trial not long ago. It should be around somewhere. Nobody can throw this away. There was, you know, it's quite a little bit of evidence that was collected at the scene, her clothing and some swabbings and slides and other things. And there was something that was used in a sexual assault that could be tested. And we searched, and my lawyer, Bob Morin, who's a judge now in Washington, D.C., went to Towson Courthouse to look for the evidence. He went a couple times. And I think on his third try, he was, because I pestered him so much to go look, you know, I called him every day. And I said, Bob, if you don't go, I'm going to call you 20 times a day. So he finally believed me because he knew that I was pretty relentless about that.
I guess you were.
You have to, right. You know, you're going to prove your innocence. If you're innocent, the squeakiest wheel gets the most oil. So anyway, he went back. Lo and behold, it wasn't where it was supposed to be in the evidence room or wherever they keep it. It was he happened to be passing the court clerk for Judge James Smith back in those days. And he said, well, I know where that's at. It was in the judge's closet or his like an ante room or something.
Jim Smith was the judge in your case?
Yes, in my second trial. And he had it in a car. It was in a cardboard box in a paper bag in the floor. And that's what saved my life. Now, I don't know about your listeners or you, but I think that criminal justice shouldn't be relied upon just by a treasure hunt.
No.
I think we should really go to great lengths to
stuff
keep evidence.
Some of it, stuff should not be landing in cardboard boxes in the back of some judge's
absolutely.
Office.
But they took it, and it went to one of the DNA labs in the United States, and the rest is history, as they say.
And you're fighting for other men and women's lives, which is the important part. Clarence and Glen Burnie, you're on the air. For a quick thought, we have a few minutes left.
Hello.
Hi, Clarence. We have a few minutes left. You're on the air.
All right. Thank you. I think that it is extremely amazing that every time you turn around and you go online and look at the news, that someone is being exonerated through DNA testing for crimes that they did not commit. I mean, you're talking about men who's been on in the penal system for like 15, 20, 30 years.
Absolutely.
And perhaps the state should set aside some tax money to use that for DNA testing because of the so-called backlog and things of that nature that a lot of these DNA tests can't get done because of the funding. So it is just amazing that, because like not too long ago, someone from Texas just got exonerated for being on in the penal system for over 20 years. And it's just amazing.
I think it was like 39 years, actually, or something close to that. But, you know, you're absolutely right. It's we do have a program, and I want to tell you that it is called the Kirk Bloodsworth Post-Conviction DNA Testing Program. And it's run by Department of Justice, and we're trying to get the bill reauthorized. It just got some people out of jail. It had $17 million in it. And we got some people out of Washington State and Arizona, and it was used here in Maryland as well. They got their own Bloodsworth. So I just don't give this lip service. I've really tried to work to give people every bit of the justice they can have, and certainly just reauthorize the Bloodsworth program, and we can make this work.
Kurt Bloodsworth, it's really good to see you again, man.
You too, Mark.
And,
always.
Looking good. And I'm glad to see that it wasn't the state that ran you out, but love that ran you to boys.
That's right. That's right. So how many people could say they can go somewhere for an angel? But I can.
You did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good to see you, brother.
Nice to see you, Mark. Bye-bye.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.